Welcome back to the London Futurist podcast. Our guest today, Gert Lennard, is one of the most successful futurists on the international speaker circuit. He estimates he's spoken to a combined audience of 2.5 million people in more than 50 countries. Gert left his home country of Germany in 1982 to go to the USA to study music. While he was in the US, he set up one of the world's first internet-based music businesses, and then he parlayed that into his current speaking career. His talks and videos are known for their engaging use of technology and design, and he prides himself on his rigorous use of research and data to back up his claims and insights. Gert and I have sparred amiably for several years over the pros and cons of transhumanism, and I dare say we'll get into that in this conversation. Gert, welcome to the London Futurist podcast.
Hey guys, great to be with you.
It's great to see you, Gert.
Gert, for the last couple of years or so, you've been talking about the good future, which is an idea I like, as I think there's too much pessimism in the world, as well as too much populism, polarization, and post-truth. What do you mean by the good future?
This work came out of the film that I shot in 2021 in Lanzarote called The Good Future. And the film basically tried to describe what the good future could look like to be an antidote to all the negative future that people are always talking about. So basically, if you ask anybody now that's around 25, 30 years old, 75% or so think that the future will be terrible. Climate change and war and nuclear war and what have you. So this is the antidote. The good future idea is to say, what is good on the bottom line, like not dying, having enough to eat, having rights, self-realization and so on, and how do we get there? Also at the bottom line. Not saying how do we all get rich or so, or how do we solve inequality or so, but just the bottom line, how do we get to a future that is going to be positive? And how do we describe it? I really believe very strongly in this, and this is now my main topic, that we must have a new narrative on the future. A narrative that the future can be good, that we have all the cards, that it's up to us to create it, and that we have a positive outlook because that creates a positive reality.
And you talk about planet, purpose, and people. Is that right? You've got your three Ps. Can you give us a quick overview of what that means?
Yes, I'm riffing off Elkington, John Elkington, who said people, planet, profit. I say people, planet, purpose, and prosperity. I think purpose is crucial because it's a question of meaning. This is, for example, the AI discussion. It's about meaning. And basically what that means is that we have to move beyond this idea that everything is about growth and profit and economic gains. That has worked well for a while, I would admit it, also for me, of course, but it isn't going to work. It's unfit in the future because we're emphasizing all the right things for progress, but all the other things are falling by the wayside, mostly people and planet. So in other words, we're increasing the capital gains, the capital structure pretty much of all developed countries. People are getting a bit more money. But the planet is declining like this. So we're going to live in a world where some of us, 10% of us, have more money, but then there's no place to be. That's why I'm saying it's really important that we create new stock markets, a new way of paying dividends based on those four principles. And if you don't tick all four, you get nothing. You basically have to tick all four boxes. Otherwise, you can't be a success.
Gert, I've seen a lot of your work, and it is encouraging and impressive. But I also see people commenting on it, and they say the route to a bad future is fairly obvious. It's quite clear how we're going to end up in that bad future. The good future looks attractive, but people struggle sometimes to understand exactly what we must do in order to make that good future a reality. I think you started to answer that question by your mention of new kinds of stock markets, but you must have more to offer to that question.
I'm with Kevin Kelly, you know, a famous futurist at Wired magazine and overall mentor of all of us, who says that we should be optimists not because we have less problems and less challenges. We have a lot of those. We should be optimists because we have more capacity to deal with them. Our means of addressing disease, water, energy, climate change are exploding. Very soon, the car can go 2,000 kilometers on one electric charge, and a battery on the iPhone will last 6 weeks, and we're all going to live to be 100 years old. Look at all of these achievements. The only thing that we need is better policy, better collaboration, a better story about the future, and a better economics.
So what is that better policy? What is that better economics? You sound like you don't like capitalism very much, so Are you a socialist? What economic model would you propose?
You know, I think that these words, capitalist, socialism, communism, are kind of useless now because we're in an exponential age. And we talk about that all the time. And so going back to those words, a lot of things that Marx said weren't wrong, and a lot of things that Milton Friedman said weren't wrong. We're now moving into a future where it has to be about more than growth, economic growth. It has to be something that moves towards what some people funnily call the Star Trek economy. We have more collective benefit, collective goals, and we're going to go beyond the Earth, clearly. That's another thing. We're going to transcend humanity, parentheses, in ways that is unheard of. We can reach this kind of potential, as Kevin says, protopia, or stepwise hopping into the future. But we need to fundamentally change the way that we work together. For example, be more collaborative with a global consciousness and all of these things. That will force us into a different stock market scenario, which we can hardly call capitalism, but I would say it's progressive capitalism or social capitalism, as we say in Europe.
That's interesting, and I want to dig into that, but I do want to echo your use of Kevin Kelly's word protopia. I think it's such a brilliant concept. The idea is that at the moment, people think either there's a dystopia or there's a utopia. Those are the two opposites. Dystopia, terribly bad. Utopia, perfect. And the idea of perfection in human affairs is ridiculous. We'll never get there. And it would be boring if we could, because nothing changes. There'd be no fun. Kevin Kelly proposed the idea of protopia, which is a world where everything is really pretty good, and it just keeps getting better day by day. So I think we should be aiming at protopia. From some people's point of view, this world that we're in perhaps already is, compared, say, to what life was like for pretty much all humans before the Industrial Revolution. But you're very critical of capitalism, but you think we need a sort of reformed capitalism. I think I would dispute the idea that capitalism is all about growth. Capitalism is an economic system, and it goes very well with liberal democracy, which enshrines a lot of brilliant things about human flourishing that we want. Freedom, freedom from want, and also freedom of expression and so on. But if you want to reform capitalism so that we have abundance and the Star Trek economy, what exactly does that look like? Do companies still exist? Are they still in private ownership and their shares traded on the stock market? Or does some form of the state take over all the companies, take over all the means of production, exchange, and distribution, and distribute the assets among citizens in a fair way? What is your vision of the structured arrangement of society in this new exponential world?
This is, of course, not a trivial question or a black or white question. I am definitely for the free market. I'm definitely for technology and science progressing. However, too much of a good thing can be a very bad thing. When we think about having a free market that does not tackle our fundamental problems, like the free market will not tackle climate change. Yes, there are some free market mechanisms, like in America, coming to fruition now. But this is a paradigm change of what we want. The question of purpose is not a necessary economic question.
But Gert, it's a bit of an arch alley to say that capitalism won't solve climate change. Of course it won't. The reason why 40% of GDP in most developed countries is spent by the government is that everybody recognizes that the market can't take care of everything. There are lots of externalities. And you need governments to provide welfare states for citizens, to provide incentives for people to develop particular types of products and services, and to regulate markets. That's not a revolutionary idea. The market needs to be directed.
I think basically what is happening now, I see this all the time in my work when I speak to CEOs and companies. There are a lot of people who have a larger view on life. People plan their purpose, prosperity. But if they carry it out in their company, they get whacked because basically the stock market says, what are you doing here? Where's my dividend? That's like Unilever, right? This is a fantastic story, same story. They try and they try and they try and they try and they keep getting whacked because the stock market says one thing. You can be very evil and do very evil things. And if you make lots of money, it's fine. See Facebook, Aramco.
That is such an odd Sally. Good. If you are a company doing evil things, your company is going to fail pretty quickly because customers are going to hate you and you're going to lose your business.
I don't mean those kind of evil things. I mean evil business. For example, Aramco is the biggest company in the world. And fossil fuel industry is killing us. I think it won't be long before companies like that are criminalized, Right now, they're making a lot of money, and the stock market is quite happy taking the money from them. And the same goes for Facebook.
And we're all very happy using their products and services. You drive a car. You keep the lights on at night. That all comes from oil at the moment because that's the resource we've got.
No.
That's the resource that's moved us out of an agrarian society.
But Callum, if a company like Aramco sends 80 people to the COP27 summit, their job is to tell people, no uncertain terms, that fossil fuel reduction cannot be mentioned in the final agreement, and they achieved their goal. At the same time, they're growing the green economy like crazy in Saudi Arabia, for example. That just isn't right. What it is, it's saying like, okay, I'm going to be in the new economy, but I'll hang on to the old until we have 4 degrees warming, and then we'll take our money and run. This is really the kind of aberration that I'm talking about. Here in Switzerland, I work with companies, banks and others, and they tell me all the time, we want to do this, but if we were to prioritize people and planet and purpose over our dividend, it would not end well for us. And that is a fundamental mistake in our thinking, that we prioritize all that stuff over anything else. And the same is happening with AI right now. This is a potential new gold rush. We throw caution aboard and say, let's do a surge with AI. You know, I'm going to be the leader and never mind what comes out the other end. I don't think that's right.
Gerd, do you look at examples such as the Montreal Protocol, in which governments basically told chemical industries some time ago, you've got to cut down your use of a certain chemical, CFCs, which were in refrigerators and in aerosols, because it was determined that there was this connection to the hole in the ozone layer. And at first, the chemical company said, you shouldn't interfere, we know our industry best. But the politicians did insist, and that steered the chemical companies to discover much better alternatives. Is that the kind of steering of the free market you've got in mind?
I think that is a very good example. It can't be done in every component, because the problem will always be, do we agree on a global level on what is good or bad? It was totally clear CFCs were bad, so no question there. But if an AI chatbot is giving answers to people, and people stop thinking their own answers and searches, is that good or bad? These are the kind of questions that I think they have to be collaborated upon on a global level. We have to agree on the bottom line, not on the little details. If we agree, for example, that using face recognition for interviews for jobs is not legal, shouldn't be legal in my view. This is just one example of the same kind of protocol. And I think we're going to see global moratoriums on AGI for that reason.
On the point of the rise of use of potentially dangerous AI, I noticed on my Twitter feed this morning, somebody with connections into the Bing search team in Microsoft saying they have an internal conflict. Their responsible AI people are saying, let's take this step by step, let's check things out. Sometimes ChatGPT is issuing some very strange comments. And on the other hand, many of the team are saying, you've got to rush, can't hold back. We need to get this integrated as quickly as possible. We've got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to beat Google. That wasn't all in the tweet that I'm reading behind the scenes. And I'm fairly sure that these pressures are going to lead some of the safety advocates to be sidelined or to have their voices muted. And I agree with you. I think we need to do more to assist the safety advocates in these companies and their managers who want to be on their side. We have to provide them a framework. We have to provide them some regulations. But it's hard to see how that will work, frankly. So how do you think that will work?
It is very hard to see how that works. And I just want to build on that, because you're talking about Microsoft, which is a company which has an enormous amount to lose from a consumer backlash and is run by very decent, respectable people. I don't particularly like the way Microsoft issues its products, but it's a company that is trying to do good things. The world has got a lot of people who do not give a damn about that. Imagine Putin having the ability to create the AGI. Fortunately, he's made such a mess of the Russian economy, he probably never will have such a chance. But there are plenty of actors, as computers get exponentially cheaper, who will have the ability to create AGI. And there is simply no way we're ever going to be able to all collectively agree, all 8 billion of us, not to do it. If it's possible, it's going to happen. And if it's going to happen, it's going to happen as soon as it possibly can.
My pitch is not to do it. I look at this like nuclear energy. And there's a great film coming out on Netflix very soon about Oppenheimer and his whole role in this discussion, called Oppenheimer, I think. What happened there is we had two bombs, and the Americans threw the bomb on the city, not in the ocean, to cause the effect, devastating effect, even though they could have done differently. And then 14 years later, we got together and we said, not everybody should have bombs. And we're going to use this energy for power plants. Now, I think we're going to have the same thing. We're going to say, okay, we can build an AGI that can solve superhuman problems and that can basically be used for all these things. But not everybody should push the button on this AGI to create paramilitary that can be with an IQ of a billion or so. And that has to be a global thing.
But Gert, that comparison really doesn't work. To build a nuclear bomb is really hard. You need the apparatus of a very rich state, and you need quite a bit of time. The Iranians have been trying to do it, and that's not a trivial state. 40 million people, a lot of oil money. They've been trying to do it for years and have failed. Building AGI, there are two AGI labs in the world at the moment, DeepMind and OpenAI. These are two companies, one owned by Google, the other a startup in San Francisco, both explicitly trying to create AGI. OpenAI, from what we know, costs about £3 billion to get, or $3 billion to get where it is now. It's now got a hell of a lot more money from Microsoft. So it costs about $3 billion to set up an AGI lab. That's actually not all that much money, and it's going to get a lot cheaper. So you can't say, look, we managed to slow down and impede the development of nuclear weapons and limit their availability, therefore we can do it with AGI. The comparison simply doesn't work.
Well, first I would contest that. I think it is hard and costly, super costly, to really want to create an AGI. And of course, there are Chinese companies doing the same thing. You need lots of data, lots of computing power. Effect is showing, for example, that if you were to integrate ChatGPT into a search engine, it wouldn't work. You can't do a billion searches like this.
No, of course, now. It doesn't work now, but it will in the future.
Yeah, but I think it's still pretty hard to do that. The other thing is that it's not necessarily about not having it, like I said earlier, but agreeing on what exactly it should do, what its limits are, and what its governance is. Because if we end up with an AI arms race, we will all lose. I bet you money this is already happening. I bet you $100 that Chinese and Americans are collaborating, parenthesis, on a scientific level, on these debates. And so are Europeans, and I very much hope so that this will be the case. Because I really believe, like Sam Altman said, this could be potentially the moon landing moment for AI. And it will change everything if it works. But then again, too much of a good thing can also be not a good thing. And so how do we do that? This is not a trivial question. But one of the key answers is, let's get away from this thinking that's driving, I think, a little bit Microsoft and OpenAI, that they are going to have huge financial gains and so out with it. Just go forward, make money. This will not work. It's unsafe, unsecure, dehumanizing, and confusing for the market, in my view. So a little bit less orientation on the money, a bit more collective benefit, I think would be a good thing.
Who decides the collective benefit? You say people, planet, prosperity, but people have got different views as to what a true flourishing person should be. Is a true flourishing person somebody who lives to 100 and then dies? Or is a true flourishing person somebody who can live 1,000 years and maybe even move into a post-biological form? How are these discussions going to be progressed?
Again, I keep it down to the macro level, not the detailed level, whether you live 150 or 1,000 years or whether you have two cars or four. Let's keep it on a very basic level. I think most people agree, I've done a lot of research on this, the good future means I get to live nicely, have family, have food, express myself, have liberties, have rights, have a job, realize my goals, that's it. Basic water, food, safety, disease, those kind of things. Financial gains, okay, those are higher up on the pyramid of needs. So I think the good future is where we can make that happen for everybody. And that I think most people, even a Taliban fighter, would agree that having the liberty to have family and to eat and not be killed is good.
Well, he might agree that as long as you're a man.
Right. In any case, I think we have a lot of agreement on those basic things.
Good. I'm sorry. I don't think we do have a lot of agreement on those things. You say you go a certain distance up Maslow's hierarchy of needs and you stop at the financial freedom. Other people say, no, hell with that. I want to go to financial freedom. I want to include that in my basic human rights, is the opportunity to, if I'm able to, if I'm lucky enough, to secure complete financial liberty so I never have to work again. That's within my rights. A lot of people would say that. And then other people would say, actually, it's also my right to build a company and to own a company, which can actually have a big influence on the world.
I think it's fine to say that. I think on a policy level, we need to cover that lower ground first. In a free market, which I believe is fundamentally what we need still, there will be lots of room for people to do that. In the Star Trek economy, remember Star Trek, you have those people. Regardless of all of the equality and this lack of money and all these kind of things, you have important people, you have important enterprises. And I think this is what we're looking at right now. It's just we have to get away from this one-track mind, especially for us. You have to remember that we're talking about 10% of the population that have caused 90% of the pollution. And that's still true. This can't continue. We're going to have a more global consciousness approach on these goals.
One thing you included in your vision of the good future is everybody has the right to have a job. What do you say to people who suggest, and I'm one of them, that there won't be paid jobs in the future for the majority of people because our AIs will be doing most of the work better than us?
I'm totally with you on that. Don't call it a job, call it occupation if you want. I'm a great believer in the universal basic income. If we play our cards right, we're going to see the opportunity for technology doing most of the hard work, the commodity work, and maybe we'll just eventually actually end up at the place where we only work 2 hours a day for the same money. And then sooner or later, we don't work, parenthesis, we work for the common good in some way, and we get money anyway. It's hard to decide how that will happen. And again, it's subject not to the fact that we don't have the tech. We do have the tech, and we're going to have more tech. This is a question of policy.
Yeah.
Are we going to prioritize the money on one hand, which is, of course, the tech and the people that run it and the people that regurgitate it? Or are we going to spread the fire hose of money and call that socialism? That's a big question.
Yeah, that is the big question, isn't it? How we tackle the economic singularity. If we get to the point where machines can do pretty much everything that we can do for money, and they can do it cheaper, better, and faster than us, we're going to need a new sort of economy. I think it should probably be based on capitalism, but maybe not, which has a way of distributing the value that is created by the machines to everybody. But look, we spent a lot of time squabbling about economic policy. Let's go and squabble about transhumanism, because it's the thing that you and I have been talking about for years. Broadly speaking, transhumanism is the belief that humans should be free to improve our cognitive and physical abilities. And we should be free to do things which will take us way beyond current human abilities. So smart drugs and then brain-computer interfaces will improve our minds and our cognitive abilities enormously. Replacement limbs, replacement organs, prosthetics, and ultimately cyborg existence will improve our physical capabilities enormously. Now, David and I are transhumanists. We think that should all be allowed with due regulation and due caution. There are obviously things that can go wrong with that progress, but in principle, that progress should be allowed. And I think you think we shouldn't be doing that because you think that there is something important about being human and that should be preserved. And it wouldn't be too hard to become post-human. You are uncomfortable with the idea of humans becoming post-human. Is that right?
Those are, of course, many different questions at the same time. I think anything that helps us to have a higher quality of being human, which may include living longer or even forever, anything that makes us more human is fair game. I think anything that's dehumanizing and potentially making us into a sort of semi-machine, I don't see the gain there. I see the gain, for example, saying, okay, I'm going to use artificial intelligence to connect to the global trove of knowledge and find a way to assimilate that. But on the other hand, I'd be really worried about that becoming sort of like oxygen, so that without that, I cannot exist independently from it. And that would get me really worried, because thinking like, okay, if I need to have the brain-computer interface to actually exist, which could very well be the case then, do I still have my independence as a human? And what does it do for also equality and those kind of issues? I think at a certain point, I would say that, again, too much of a good thing is probably a very bad thing. What are we giving up in return? For example, I would say that using ChatGPT for my searches, it's a potential like a laziness generator. I'm too lazy to make up my own mind, so I'll find my own mind by somebody else telling me what it is. This is a potential danger.
So do you use Google Maps?
It's actually a very good example. I use Google Maps with that in mind, that I would question it. Don't take it as the gospel. And that's exactly what it does. And this is the great thing about Google and search in general. I look at this and saying, no. I'm not going to click on that link. It sounds stupid. Or I'm not going to turn here because I know better. And a bot that I speak to on my wristwatch with voice commands, which is coming very shortly, and I say, what kind of authority does this machine have? Knowing, of course, there's really no truth, non-truth in that particular way. But it should still be trackable. It should not be a black box. And then we humans are so believing of technology. We anthropomorphize all the time that we will probably say, okay, that's the answer. Thanks. I'll buy this. I'm not so sure that this is the right process because it will lead us to a kind of blind belief. And it may destroy democracy also because this information isn't verified. It could be anything. It could be fantastic or irrelevant or just completely fabricated.
It seems to me every new technology we adopt makes us forget how to do something, a skill which we had before. I have no ability to make a fire from scratch. I need matches or a fire lighter. I couldn't rub two flints together and make a fire. It would take me all day. Whereas my ancestor hundreds of thousands of years ago could have done it in moments. And I don't regret the loss of that skill. I have no ability to go out and hunt a rabbit for my dinner. Supermarkets exist which will sell me a rabbit which has been prepared and cooked and so on. Although I'm increasingly vegetarian, so more like plants, I have no ability to grow plants. And I don't regret that lack of ability because it means I can spend my time doing other things. And ChatGPT is just another in the very long line of those technologies which liberates us from doing drudgery, which we used to have to do, frees us up to be able to do more interesting things.
I'm with Gert. There are risks that if we become too dependent on particular infrastructures or technologies and these infrastructures fail, for example, there could be a big solar flare. There was a big solar flare in, 1859 called the Carrington event, which knocked out the primitive communication structure of the time, which was telegraphs. If a similar thing were to strike the Earth today, possibly an even larger one, many of our electronic systems could be fried, potentially, and then would we be especially vulnerable? So I think some humans should know how to kindle fires from scratch. Some humans need to know all the other techniques. And if I was an AGI, I would set exercises for humans to make sure that we could still do square roots on paper and pencil rather than being relying on calculators. So I think we need to keep a wise eye on things. But that shouldn't stop us moving forwards and changing our opinion as to what is truly of the human essence. I'm reminded of the example of anesthetics during childbirth. This was quite a controversial thing 200 years ago, or maybe 170 years ago, when some of the preachers said to women, it's an absolutely important part of the female existence to cry out in utter pain and devastation during childbirth. After all, it was written in the book of Genesis that this was part of the human condition. And when women said, including Queen Victoria, they wanted to bypass that part of human experience, thank you very much, they would prefer to have an anesthetic, various preachers refused. But in the end, Queen Victoria laid down her monarchical rights and helped to flip that. Nowadays, very few people would deny women who want that anesthetic the right to have it. So we change our mind as to what's essential for our experience. And I think we're likely to change our mind in the future. In the future, maybe children will be born in external wombs. Some women might choose to have them their quartz natural way, but many others, it's an extension of the C-section. Are we really going to tell these women, no, you can't do this, it's a fundamental part written in the Bible that you have to have children the old-fashioned way? I think our minds will change, but I'm with you. We have to do it thoughtfully and look at all the risks as well as the benefits.
Well, I think you've said that very well, David. I agree with all of that. Firstly, you know, the technology liberates us and we should embrace that and champion it. And it would be a good idea to have some people retaining some of the basic skills that you need if there is no electricity. But, you know, let's not kid ourselves. If there was a solar flare and it knocked out our computers, I think most people would die. I would die. If the supermarkets stopped providing food, where am I going to get food from? And what am I going to do about all the other hundreds of thousands of people in whatever city I happen to be in also looking for food? I'm a goner, and so are most of us. We have to make sure our systems are as resilient as they can be to stop that happening. We're probably not doing a good enough job. But technology does make us dependent on it, and there's nothing we can do about that.
There's an apple and oranges thing here, of course, in that being able to make up my own judgment and to think for myself is different than starting a fire. By the way, I can still start a fire also. To not being able to use my own judgment to outsource thinking, these machines aren't thinking. We're far away from that. They're barely talking. They're definitely not thinking, not like humans do. But if I were able to outsource my decision making, I should retain the ability to question and to be myself. And I think this is important on a gradual level. Okay, so I would be in trouble if there was no food or water. But maybe I could think enough to figure out what to do, because I'm still thinking at that point. But when I get connected to a digital network, by default, like many science fiction films tell us, and then the net goes down, then I'm incapable, completely incapable. So it's a question of magnitude. And I think you're right. It may eventually turn up. We don't need to think about that very much anymore. I kind of think that's not the case for exogenesis. After all, these are humans, not robots that we're giving birth to. That would be my main argument here. But yes, I would grant that may be the case. Eventually, we can think of that as being safe and normal, but I don't know.
I'm with you on that we must be careful not to outsource our hard decisions. There's a concept called the moral singularity by Jamie Bartlett, the Demos writer, who says that once we start to trust our systems to make the hard decisions for us, we will lose that skill, just like we lose the ability to calculate square roots in paper and pencil. And then we will no longer be able to evaluate, are these decisions suggested to us by our AIs the right ones? Today, with ChatGPT, we still got the ability to interrogate it and say, well, it's told me this, but I can check, and it's not true. Whereas in the future, if we have lost the ability to practice that, I think we will be in a dangerous place. So I'm very much in favor of humans remaining in control, but I think it has to be a nuanced and subtle thing. Because if we do have ChatGPT and its successors on our side, they will often suggest better solutions to us than we thought of ourselves. And once they've suggested these better solutions, then we can contemplate them and say, ah, this is the right combination of free market enterprise and regulations and whatever else is needed, new metrics and new stock market systems.
There's a great example with ChatGPT. If I asked ChatGPT to fix my computer and tell me why this isn't working and what cables do I need, it's great. It gives me great answers. I can zero in. I can buy the right stuff. It's trivial stuff. It's a question of scale. But then I say, I have a problem with my wife. It's not the same. It easily solves my tech problems. But the other problems are human. They're multinary problems. We live in the real life. And this is the main beef I have with AI and ChatGPT. Humans live in real life. Real life is not a machine yet. Real life isn't just data. Real life is feelings, emotions, skin, touch, sound, everything. Machines don't have that. We should not pretend that they live in real life. They live in their own world.
I think it won't be very long. In fact, you could argue it's already here that machines can give humans very, very good advice about how to deal with other humans because they are able to pass all the data that is exchanged between humans and work out what kind of strategies work and which kind of don't. However, I do completely agree with David that at least until we get artificial general intelligence, a machine with all the cognitive abilities of an adult human, and then superintelligence, which will presumably follow fairly soon after, until that point, humans must remain in control. We make the decisions, and we must keep our critical thinking. In fact, the machines can't make the decisions for us, so we have to do that. Of course, once we get to AGI, then the world may turn upside down. We're coming very much to the end, but I'd like to suggest what might be the nub of the philosophical difference between you and at least me, Gert, I suspect, David, I don't know, which is that you think there is something really important about being human, whereas I think what's important about us is what's in our minds. And I think if we were to move our minds to a new substrate, which was by no conceivable means human, in the sense that the definition of human is the ability to create new humans in the traditional way, that's a pretty much a good biological definition of a species. If we were to be able to move our minds into computers and enormously improve our cognitive abilities and live much more fruitful and enjoyable lives, I think that would be a good thing. Whereas I think you would think it was disastrous because we had left our humanity behind. Is that right?
Pretty much. You know, I think every psychologist will tell you that we don't think with the brain or the mind, we think with the body. We're all one thing. If we remove pieces of that one thing, at a certain point, we're no longer that thing. And I think this is completely devoid of any religious feelings or any such thing. I have no such concerns whatsoever. I'm just saying, I think that we remove pieces of this and then this equation falls apart and then we become a commodity.
That, I think, is a very good place at which to draw a conclusion. Good. Thank you. This has been a really interesting and robust conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you have.
Yes, I have.
And I hope our listeners will as well. And to our listeners, please do give us a nice 5-star rating on wherever you get your podcast. And we'll see you on the next London Futurist podcast.
Thank you, Gert.
Thank you.